that. This means that talks will be recorded pretty much by other people, which is important. So today, this morning, we have Adrian. Adrian James is going to talk on many worlds and one world interpretations of quantum theory.
Thanks very much, Lucy. And apologies to everybody for technical problems. And it's great to be here. So, Heath, that's my title. This is what I want to do. I thought to start with that I might try and set out at length one or two of the arguments and then give a really detailed critique of them. But I concluded then that's not really worth all the time available. So what I'd like to do is give something of a potted introduction, so a sort of sketch of some of the interesting arguments that have come up on both sides of the debate over it. I'd be very happy to talk with people outside the lectures if you're interested. I'd also encourage anybody who's interested to go to the original literature and to the various online references that either already exist or soon will. So apologies to you and to the authors that I'm not going to represent faithfully and in detail many of the arguments that are thoughtfully and carefully set out on both sides of the debate. I'm just going to touch on them and sort of introduce some of the key ideas. If you want to pursue this further, well, there's a conference at PI later next month. It's the 50th anniversary of the Everett Foundation. And this commemorates it. Many worlds at 50. If you're particularly interested in coming along, you'd be very welcome, and registration is still open. But in any case, the talks are all in the video archive on the web. Also celebrating the 50th anniversary of the recent meeting organised by the Oxford Philosophers of Physics, in particular by Simon Saunders and David Wallace. And that was in July, and the videos are already online. There's the reference. Here is the front of the t-shirt, and here, which I rather liked, although I didn't agree with it, is the back of the t-shirt.
Which part did you disagree with?
Well, I'm not so convinced that the measurement problem ended up being solved, which is why they're wearing it.
What is the HTTP
there? Oh,
is
sorry.
Users?
This is not readable. users.ox.ac.uk/Everett. All lowercase. No problem in that. Okay, so both of those meetings will either are already or will be archived online. Another reference that may be familiar. No, that doesn't work at all. Does that help?
Turn on the lights.
No.
Turn on the light.
Does that? I'm not sure I understand this technology at all. Okay. There's a collection that dates back to 1973, edited by Quentin Grayer, The Many Worlds Interpretation of Quantum Mechanics. I think it's rather dated now, and in any case, the articles are of variable quality. But it includes Everett's original paper, which, of course, is published in the journal, but also his unpublished thesis, elaborating much greater length his ideas. And there are interesting articles by Witt and some other papers that are still worth reading. So what was Everett's original claim? Well, I've set out a few quotes which say very clearly what Everett was trying to do. Here's the first one. This paper seeks to clarify the foundations of quantum mechanics. Good. It presents a reformulation of quantum theory in a form believed suitable for application to general instruments. Also sounds good. The aim is not to deny or contradict the conventional formulation of quantum theory, but rather to supply a new, more general, and complete formulation from which the conventional interpretation can be deduced. I've underlined that, Everett italicized that. He particularly wanted to stress that we could derive the Copenhagen interpretation from his interpretation. whether that's true or not, has been populated ever since. But then really claim it. Everett goes on to say, the new theory is not based on any radical departure from conventional one. The special postulates in the old theory which deal with observation are omitted in the new theory. We don't have prediction postulates. That's essentially what it means there. The altered theory has to be analysed in and for itself before any identification becomes possible between the qualities of the theory and the properties of the world of experience. So there's promise there that work has to be done, but also that it can be done, and that we can recover an explanation of why we see the world the way we do from Everett's more general perspective. And Everett was also admirably clear about the nature of reality in his interpretation. So from the viewpoint of the theory, all elements of the superposition, all, quote, branches, unquote, are, quote, actual, unquote. None any more, quote, real, unquote, than the rest. It's unnecessary to suppose that all but one are somehow destroyed, since all the complete elements of the superposition individually obey the wave equation with complete indifference to the presence or absence, the actuality or not, of any other elements. This total lack of effect of one branch from another also implies that no observer will ever be aware of any splitting process. And arguments, and as soon as Everett presented his ideas, he was presented with counter arguments. So his response to the first wave of them was this, in a footnote in the paper. Arguments that the world picture presented by this theory is contradicted by experience, because we are unaware of any branching process, and certainly we are unaware of branching processes, are like a criticism of the Copernican theory that the mobility of the Earth is incompatible with common sense, because we feel no such motion. I've omitted the text, but I haven't changed the sense here. In both cases, the theory itself predicts that our experience will be what it in fact is. So we can encapsulate at least basic intuition underlying this story and these claims in an example that I think you probably, most if not all of you, have seen. Something like the canonical example that Everettians will present when they're trying first to introduce that thing. Let's see what we have here. We have a system. I have an apparatus that I've just represented to start with by an empty dial. I have you, and I've represented you, and this is your head, and I'm going to draw the contents of your mind inside the head. And for the moment, let's assume that your brain is empty, you're just waiting for that kind of experiment. And you have a friend who's in a similar state. And we're going to have a unitary evolution in which the system and the apparatus interact according to an ideal measurement interaction. And at the moment, you're not going to look at the apparatus, and you're not going to talk to your friend. And so what happens now is that the ups component of the system gets correlated with the apparatus dial registering up, and the down component gets correlated with the dial registering down. And remember, of course, we don't apply the projection postulate as we would do, or would be allowed to do, at least in the Copenhagen interpretation. So we don't collapse between these two, we just take the superposition for those. And now I'm going to assume some further ideal interaction between you and the measurement apparatus, which is supposed to summarize what happens when you look at it. But what happens when you look at it is that your mind gets filled with the notion that the thing is pointing up, if you see an up state, and your mind gets filled with the notion that you've seen a down, if you see a down pointed state. And so in this toy model, we now have a superposition of system up, pointer up, your brain saying, aha, I saw up, your friend who's still empty-headed, and down, pointer saying down, your brain saying, aha, I saw down, friend in the same state. And just to stress that we've idealized something here, none of these things are really going to be perfect. There are going to be other terms, but let's assume this. This is a confusing expression. So the stuff that's over upside. And finally, when you can talk to your friend, or maybe or you prefer, your friend can independently look at the dial. Either way, you're going to tell him, or the dial's going to tell him, which way the pointer is. And so we arrive at a superposition in which the system and the pointer and you and your friend all agree in this component that it was the up state, and in this component it was the down state. And none of these points, and nowhere else, do we apply for a prediction possibility, and no collapse of the wave function. We just have to deal with the superposition of this form and try and supply an interpretation for it. So, it's tempting. People already start from some sort of prejudice. People whose brains seem to be sort of aligned in an Everettian sort of way say, well, there's nothing particularly puzzling about this sort of thing. It's saying that there are two different branches, if you like, two different parts of reality. And in this one, you really did see the result up, and your friend talked to you and got the answer up. And in this one, you saw the result down, and your friend talked to you and got the answer down. And that may seem puzzling at first sight, but physics tells us lots of puzzling things, fundamental physics in particular. But it's not fundamentally puzzling. And if you introspect and say, did I really see up in this branch? Well, you can look at the dial again and still say yes. You can talk to your friend and they'll say, he'll agree that's what you told him, or he'll agree that's what he saw. So in neither branch does one seem to get any contradiction or any sense that there's a way for the brain state in this branch to become aware of stuff that's going on in this branch. There doesn't seem to be a way of introducing into the model, at least in any simple technological way, something that would cause an interaction between the two branches. Question? Yep.
Yeah, I have this question. So now you have this two-split system, yes, and you write it up on some preferred basis.
Mm.
And it looks to me as if this is sort of important for the whole process, yes, because if I were to write it out in some other basis, then my brain would look differently, yes? Ah, okay.
Yes, good. Before we get on to that, yeah.
How am I supposed to interpret the errors? Does this still go through? It's not an ideal process?
The errors. Well, that's a good question. I think already the sort of traditional candidate, it gets a bit fuzzy at this point. You might say something like, well, this stuff is order of silence, that can't be very, very important in our description of the world. Or you might be.
Are those corrections coming from unitary evolution or something that is unknown?
They could be coming from the fact that the measurement isn't perfect, so it doesn't actually perfectly align up. It could be coming from interactions with the environment that might cause errors.
It's all Schrödinger
equation. So in principle, it's all Schrödinger equation, but we sort of neglected the environment completely in this discussion. If we were going to be completely honest, we should include that. We assume that all the interactions are perfect, and none of them really are.
So other worlds, maybe?
Maybe there are other worlds. Maybe we're going to have to postpone worrying about that for the time. But there has to be some, you're right, of course, there's going to have to be some sort of story about why we can apparently neglect stuff that looks small in the wave function. And don't take me to be saying that this can be resolved. I'm not so sure it can. Yep.
I mean, in the real world, the we're trying to reconcile this theory with, it does occasionally happen that, you know, you think it was up and I think it was down, right? I mean,
right.
There is noise in the real world, so if there's an error in theory, that jives with our experience, right?
Well, if that's... Maybe. Maybe. I mean, the trouble is, we need. It seems as though we need to say something more like that. I mean, in the world we actually experience, most of the time we do agree, and from time to time we don't agree. Very, pretty rarely we don't agree, and we say something like, probably we will. There's a fact of the matter, one way or the other. Probably we will agree, but there's some small probability that we won't agree. So if we could recover some account like that from the way function I wrote down, all would be well and good. But we've clearly got to do more work than we've done so far to have any hope of doing that. Of course, we've got to start saying something about probability or something that at least played a role with probability. So intuitively, if that's going to work at all, it has to be connected to the amplitude and use some sort of one size squared rule. But we've got to say more than that stuff. I'll come back to that. So, yeah.
Well, just a comment. What Robin was saying, it sounds like you would just have another ket appended there for some other spin, some other state similarly prepared, and then the friend is, or the another apparatus, another person, or, you know, your friend becomes entangled with that, which could in principle be slightly different than the original.
Yeah, so we could add. We can have things that look like sort of reasonably intelligible worlds with small amplitude to that. But I guess there's still going to be further corrections that aren't so easily interpretable. Even that's still an idealized model. So we're going to have to do more. Okay, so this is going to happen, I think, throughout the discussion. We're going to switch back and forth between throwing out arguments that might help us make sense of this idea, and then counter-arguments that may or may not prove devastating, at least to some particular line of thought. Okay, so here's, it's already been raised, here's one of the early and traditional and obviously still relevant objections to the story I just gave. The question of the preferred basis. I wrote down not just the spin system, but the final state, as a combination of these two states. Why did I do that? Well, one might suspect I did that because it looks as though I kind of know how to interpret this state and this state in terms of the sort of world we see. But I didn't have to write it down in this form. After all, these two are just two orthogonal vectors in Hilbert space. We might as well abbreviate our notation and call the first one 0, the second one 1, and they're orthogonal. And I could have written that linear combination, A times the first plus B times the second, for instance, as this combination A plus B over root 2 times plus. Maybe I should define my plus and minus states. That was it. Sorry. So these are the standard plus or minus states. Linear combination is 0 and 1. And that's one example, but there are infinitely many different ways I could write this. What justified using the particular representation that seems to have a nice interpretation? That seems to give us a story which we could try, at least start to try to make sense of, the universe splitting into distinct and yet macroscopically coherent, macroscopically intelligible branches. And you can press that objection a little further. More generally, how are we going to proceed when we discuss the universal wave function? What is going to tell us exactly when we have a splitting taking place? Exactly when? Somewhere on the sort of kind of given, it seems to happen somewhere between the situation when no measurement is taking place and the situation where we would agree, but exactly where? And exactly what form they take. Why can we use one representation or another? Do we need something like a new law of nature in order to characterize the ever larges? Yeah?
If you have decomposing indexes,
yeah.
Except Hamiltonian, which you've got, which is causing these intangibles,
yeah.
Would you then have the guy with his head in an X?
I guess you'd have a linear combination of guy with head in, head up, and guy with head down in each term, which isn't the same thing as guy with head in X.
Does that not single out a preferred
basis? Well, what exactly is the rules being proposed here? Is it something like
that you should have
definite brain space?
Yeah.
Maybe. I'm going to say more about this. It's a thought, but the equations didn't seem to tell us that definite brain states were relevant. So one better say, we shouldn't just pluck rules out of thin air and say, this is what I want to do, so let's do it. One better be clear about why that's right in these. Okay. So the question is, do we need a new law of nature that tells us what branches are and when they happen? And I guess one possible response, and one that it's been a minority view, but even from time to time, Everettians toyed with the idea. One possible response is, yes, actually we do need a new law of nature to characterize the Everett branches. And here's the sort of thing, and this is probably too simplistic, but here's the sort of thing that you might hope might emerge. We have some axioms, and we're not quite sure what form they take, but some sort of axioms, and they're going to list for us a set of times. So we're going to start with an initial state, maybe unitary evolves for a while, and then our axioms are going to spit out a time t-naught, and at time t-naught, this state splits. This is our first branching. And each splitting here is going to be defined by some predictive decomposition. So at time t naught, the axioms also produce for us some characterized predictive decomposition. Let's call it p sub naught, sup I, so I labels the different predictors. And in this case, there's supposed to be two of them. They're orthogonal order, of course. So they split psi into two orthogonal states, psi 1 and psi 2. And then our axioms go on to say, well, we're going to focus on psi 1 for the moment. That splits again at some other time. So we reduce view, time t1, 0. There's another predictive composition called pi, sub 1, 0, associated with that. Here's that splitting. And, well, we can follow whichever branch we like, but on this branch, the axioms will tell us another time for yet another splitting characteristic for predictive decompositions. And over here, more splittings are taking place, not necessarily the same sort of times on this branch as they were on this branch. And it would be nice, if it was going to help us interpret all this, if there's an additional property associated with all of this, which is that at any given time, all the states associated with the different branches are orthogonal. So that we have a definite, at any given time, we have a definite decomposition of the full unitary state into some presumably finite, the word setting out, finite list of orthogonal states, some sort of state. And everywhere in between the splittings, the unitary evolution takes place. So psi splits here, and psi 1 and psi 2, and then we just apply e to the minus I ht until this point. Splits again, unitary again, and so on. So for the moment, I just want to think about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, because we already seem to have enough problems for the perception making sense of that. We'd have to. But you could, if you want to sort of dream up something that sort of realistic, I guess you could do that. You could say that your axioms define some preferred hypersurface for each given splitting, and tell some story about how this happens to private services. But we're going to have trouble enough with the non-remote diversion, so let's stick with that for a moment.
Is there a significance of the length and direction of each line
No. No, I just wanted to sort of illustrate that the whole thing looks like, looks a bit like a tree, which is producing branches. The only thing that's supposed to be significant here is the time coordinate is measured all here. So here to here is represents some definite time interval.
Sorry, but it's not some matter of approximation or something. Just behind this philosophy, behind this assumption of time, there is the philosophy that time is not the property of any observer, it is something absolute behind the whole picture.
Which I think is, you might disagree, but I think is reasonable in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. So this is, as I was about to say, this isn't going to work anyway. So we shouldn't, we shouldn't get too far off about the details. But so what to say about this picture? Well, one thing to say about it is, let's suppose kind of actually that we could find a branching order of this type. And it gives us a list of branches, and this list asymptotically, well, maybe it's still finite, maybe it's discretely infinite, maybe it's even continuously infinite. But anyway, we end up with the branches eventually stopping, and we end up with some final asymptotic decomposition of the initial state into orthogonal final states. We had a law of that sort, and a list of final states. We can label each possible branch just by starting with the final state and going backwards along the tree to the initial state. So there, I've singled out one of them in green and follow another one like that, and so on. And it's not so clear, if we had a structure like this, why we would want to be assign something like a many worlds interpretation, or why we would need to do that. We seem to have at least have another option, which would be to postulate that just one of these branches is randomly chosen. We use the final probability distribution, so to speak, God rolls her dice. This final state gets picked out. In other words, this branch gets picked out, and God says, aha, okay. The true state of nature, actual reality, is going to be described by this particular structure. There's a pure state at each time. It mostly evolves unitarily, but from time to time, it collapses. And so we follow the branch. Now, perhaps one can see some sort of philosophical advantage for considering all the worlds rather than just one of them, saying that they're all real. But it's not obvious to me that it actually is it. It seems to only cause interpretational problems, and it seems, given the structure, rather to violate the spirit of Hawkins' reason. So, hypothesized that all these worlds have simultaneously been lost. Question?
Thank you.
In your initial example, you had the spin, whatever, the dial, and the command and spin. Your branching, did your branching take place when the spin picked up the dial, and then the man looked at it and told the spin, or the spin picked at it?
We weren't clear about that. I guess.
Because the problem I'm having with it is your spin interacts with the dial. Then you can assume that your system just spin plus dial is in the superposition of spin up, dial, whatever it means, and the other option.
Mm-hmm.
But then surely when your person looks at it, you won't see a superposition, you'll just see one thing. So at that point, why do you keep the other branch? that's not what you see?
Well, right, what to say about that? Well, first, there was a sort of intuition that we were trying to flesh out with this story of branches. And the intuition, which was originally Everett, is that quantum theory is actually simpler if you don't apply it. Don't even look at the prediction postulates. The intuition is that we can make sense of this story. So it's true, you are going to see some definite experimental outcome. Whatever it is suggesting is that there's, so to speak, well, more as precisely, another copy of you that saw the other outcome. And you happen to be the person who saw up, but there's somebody else who resembles you in every way, as far as details are, so the experiment is concerned. But so it's all resolved now.
So, I mean, is it kind of equivalent of assuming that you describe everything from not from your point of view, and you have to be out from your in the sense of an observer outside of you, and you're looking at information from you, from the observer outside of them, and you're looking at information from them?
But we're trying to get away from that, from the whole Copenhagen story about observers and making measurement. We're trying to set up a fundamental ontology which says once and for all what reality is. And reality is just supposed to be an entirely evolving wave function. And then we're trying to see whether or not we can make sense of, whether we can reconcile our experience, which is a definite outcome, with that ontology which includes all possible outcomes. I'm not asking you to like it. I'm not asking you to dislike it either. So, but that's what we're trying to do. Does that make some sort of sense as a sort of program one could try and follow?
Certainly.
So I think you were next.
Suppose my question is related. Now, in the theory, the universe is described as some giant wave function which undergoes smooth unitary time improvement. So then what precisely, or slightly precisely, is constitutes a branching event? I mean, in your example, I think it's more or less clear. But really, shouldn't this, I getting the idea of spin up in my brain, shouldn't that be some smooth event? So that I gradually get the idea of spin up. So, do you get my question?
I think I get the question. You're worried that the sort of picture I was suggesting here is somehow too sharp. It isn't the fact that we go straight from no knowledge to definite knowledge.
Yeah.
It sort of takes some sort of time.
It's a hard problem, yeah.
Well, it's a hard problem. again, this is a sort of hypothetical picture we haven't actually got a structure for it. But I don't think the fact that our experiences take a while to sort of register with us necessarily contradicts this picture.
This is more or less right, but I would. So is it possible to make this more precise what branching event really is?
Maybe.
Well, is that very subjective? I get the impression it's very subjective. But
there's more. Sorry to hesitate, but there's more than one line of thought.
Okay.
So the line of thought I'm playing with for the moment says, well, it should be. It's something that should be made precise. We need some extra set of axioms because it doesn't seem to follow from knowing the Hamiltonian and knowing the structure of quantum theory itself. We're not quite sure what form they take, but let's just suppose they're there. And they will say branches are characterized in the end by these lists, times, and sets of predictions.
Okay, fair.
Now that's a possible line of thought.
Okay.
There's another line of thought which is more popular among Everettians, particularly these days. Which will absolutely deny this, will say, no, this is not the right way to think about Everett. There is no fundamental branching ontology. And we're going to try with branches their structure that we as theorists impose on the theory, and we're going to need some sort of story about experience, some sort of theory of mind, in order to explain why we find it necessary to impose a branching structure. And it's going to be an inherently fuzzy thing. It's not going to be normally precise. Talk about the second line of thought. There's even a third line of thought, but I'll come to that.
This branching structure, I claim to be nothing more than wave function collapse. The missing postulates that you're talking about are the collapse postulate, and Bohr's, that's how you would get physics out of this picture. This is just going back to the orthodox picture.
Once you take the one branch view, you mean, right? They're ontologically distinct, even if we find it empirically difficult or impossible to distinguish between.
Not even that.
Yeah, they're okay. Operationally.
Of course, you're not going precisely back to Copenhagen, because Copenhagen doesn't give precise rules for when you apply the projection postulate or precisely the projection postulate. It's an art rather than science. So you're trying to, but you're producing something that looks more like a.
Doesn't give precise rules, but this does indeed.
Yeah. Sorry, well, what?
This does indeed.
Well, it was supposed
just
to
sort of imagine that they are there, but
hypothetically, in the world in which we actually have rules that give us the T's and the P's.
Okay.
this sort of story that looks rather more like some sort of elaboration of Copenhagen in the end. Yes, that's supposed to be a criticism of the slightly thought. What have we done in the end? We've gone back to something that's a bit like super Copenhagen.
Is it true that the relative state of thing after spinned up is not recorded with every branch?
So the relative phase unit. Well, I guess it is true. Yeah, but no single branch contains the information that allows you to work out the relative phase of spin up and spin down. In assuming that these two branches split and then never recombine, assuming we don't do some sort of microscopic interference experiment that involves measuring the bias in you and your friends. So assuming the branching structure is like this and without any re-mergings.
Are you allowed to recombine branches?
On this picture, let's say no, because otherwise discussion could get a bit more complicated.
This would predict that relative phases then simply cannot be observed if you can't recombine branches.
Right. Another question. How long should I be here for? Okay. So this seems at first sight one possible way to make sense of Everett. It's something that pro-Everettians themselves have toyed with. But the fact is, nobody's ever found a good set of mathematics that defines a branching tree of form that we want, and that gives us branches that look like the sort of worlds where you experience in a lucid model. You might think it's easy to do with the toy models, and if you make the toy model sufficiently ideal, it is easy to do. But in realistic models with realistic decoherence mechanisms, it's very hard, perhaps impossible, to find simple, elegant mathematical rules to produce this sort of precise structure of this sort. And my guess is it probably is impossible. Moreover, as has already been said, if anybody ever did manage to dream up a set of rules like this, it would more naturally suggest a one-world interpretation, super Copenhagen interpretation, rather than a many-world interpretation. That's okay. That would not be in keeping with Everett's original idea. But it would be very interesting to be a possible precise mathematical resolution measure. Let's just know that it's not Everett's solution. Third thing, if time permits, I suspect it won't, I'll say a bit more about this. You might want to take a look at a recent paper in the archive in which I set out an idea that pursued somewhat related lines, but works rather much better than this one. Gives so a proposal for a branching structure that just might do the trick, but isn't sharp in the sense. It doesn't split the wave function into orthogonal states. It's mathematically precise, but it's, so to speak, physically fuzzy in the sense that at any finite time, the states associated with different branches are density matrices rather than pure states, and they're generically non-orthogonal. Let's put all that aside now. And consider what these days is the much commoner response to the pervasive problem. So the first response was, yes, we do need a new physical law. And the commoner response is, no, even so upset, we don't need a new physical law. Branches are just not fundamental things. And there is no fundamental ontology that defines branches. It appears to us that we're in some sort of definite branch, because of the type of sort of creatures we are, the way our brains work, and the way we and the brain interacts with the environment. So this is following the strategy that Jeremy in his opening lectures called death at the appearance of a definite macroscopic world, despite the lack of fundamentalology, ontology that gives a macroscopic world. Let's try a new location for this. So, quite a few physicists have advocated something like this view, starting, I think, with Everett himself, Coleman, Gell-Mann and Hartl, and many, many others over the years. It seems to be something that accords with many people's intuition about how things should work. And it's a view that's lately been elaborated in some detail by Simon Saunders, David Wallace, and others, both from the Oxford Philosophy of Physics group and elsewhere. So the key idea, which I take to be implicit somewhere else that I'm learning the writing of these earlier authors, and is definitely explicit in the case of Saunders and Wallace, the key idea is the appeal to some particular ideas about the way that the mind relates to the physical world. So a particular theory of mind, a theory that goes under the name of functionalism. What is functionalism? Well, I don't know how readable this is, I'll read it out. I've quoted here from the Stanford Online Encyclopedia of Philosophy. Functionalism is the doctrine that what makes something a thought, or a desire, or a pain, or any other type of mental state, doesn't depend on its internal constitution. It doesn't depend on the fact that there's some sort of magic pain fiber that's being fired inside your brain, and pain is uniquely associated with pain fibers. It depends solely on its function, or the role it plays in the cognitive system which it's part. So it depends on what's going on in the brain and how it relates to what's going on next, and how it relates to what's happening previously, and how that relates to the perceptions that you do in the environment, and how all that relates to the behavior that you're going to express. So something like this, just interacting with a sharp object and withdrawing your hand and having signals travel up your nerve into the brain, and the signals travel up and then they travel back, and you withdraw your hand and you grimace and you say how. That whole collection of information processing and behavior is what a pain is, and it's nothing more than that. And it doesn't matter whether it's being implemented in carbon, in my case, or silicon, or it may possibly be in the case of some people in the audience, but I doubt it, or on a computer. As long as you have a system that's doing the same sort of thing, that it has that sort of relation to the environment, the damage is being caused, and a processing device is telling it the damage is being caused and telling it to avert the damage, it will be experiencing pain. But so to speak, what's important is the software, and the hardware is irrelevant.
With that trail of thought, for example, if I kick a ball against the wall and the ball starts to compress a little bit and then bounces back, would that be a ball experiencing pain?
Not a very rich response.
It's not a very rich response because it doesn't seem to have a whole range of relations to.
How many emotions?
Yeah. I don't find myself in this sort of situation where I try to defend a view that I'm really quite aware of. Can I suggest we just run with this and see how far it gets?
Is the function going to be basis dependent? I'm just kind of curious. Maybe you're going to get to this, but
I've got to get to this. Okay. Yeah.
So I agree with what you said before, that to me this function process doesn't seem less problematic than the measurement process. But what your example that you just gave was raised the question of what we have continuous touching the error, the errors in the arm, the movement. I mean, what consists of a distinct outcome from the effect on my arm?
Do we need distinct outcomes? I mean, do we need a discrete theory of mind? Maybe.
Splitting arises because incompatible possibilities cannot exist for the same universe in some sense. And so what would constitute, like, one outcome and another outcome? See what I mean? What we necessitate is splitting. Because two different things happen. To me, it's not clear how to make that. And like, to any internal process, even your body.
But when we start talking about concrete physical examples, when we start talking about can you see a point in a state up or a state down, do those seem distinct enough that we're happy to say that that's going to constitute a splitting? Your eyes are going to behave differently, there's going to be a different representation in the line, you're going to say, that was up. Yeah, all sorts of stuff will behave differently.
Yes.
Differently, your memory is going to be different, and your emotional responses.
Mm-hmm. So?
At least in the case we discussed, maybe this theory of mind is good to be able to distinguish the branches and sex. But
you just argue that it's not. I guess you just argue that even this up and down vegetation sort of problematic. Even your most basic example is
problematic. I was trying to say that really seems like two pretty grossly distinct frame states.
But in the process of seeing this, there are so many different possibilities, like how we're limited, like this proposed registering up or down.
Oh, there are lots of different ways in which you could see up and lots of different ways in which you could see down. But can we not distinguish them? Are they not still two quite distinct classes? Here's the class of up responses.
Maybe we should.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Okay,
thank you. One more question.
I feel like there's something wrong with this. I thought because you're assuming that everything has a role to play, everything has a function, but I can think of an example that's more sociological that does not seem to have a role. But for example, if someone loses his arm in the wall or something, and then he feels some ghost feelings that hurting or itching, but there's nothing to scratch. So there's some feelings that's initiated when there's nothing there and doesn't seem to have a point. So I don't see why every you know, how this can be applied to everything. There seems to be a class of things that doesn't have to come.
So you, the point there is that the input isn't really coming from outside the body, but still.
It seems to be coming from the part of the body because the person thinks that, you know, if you feel something, but there's something, there's nothing, no road for it because there's no end to it, so it doesn't seem to have a function.
It seems to then, as
Anton,
it seems to then as
coming
from outside the body, but actually
it's
generated
internally. No, it's coming from his, he feels the feeling. The feeling is registered in his brain as being, oh, it's,
sure.
I need to stretch it, but it's not going to stretch.
Right. I mean, he hasn't actually had that on, but his brain is telling him that there's pain somewhere in his head. Elbow. So that's, I agree that, I mean, that's a bit anomalous, but it still has a lot of the, there's still a lot of the story of yourself. The brain is telling him he's running through in his mind, I'm feeling pain, he's verbalizing that, he's thinking about how to deal with that.
Does this have to do with quantum theory?
Not directly. Okay. I tend to agree that certain functionalism is controversial. It's a popular theory, but I tend to agree that it's a problematic one. But we've got to decide. Either we're going to let the ever-change run with this and see where it goes, or we're going to stop the discussion at this point if we don't agree with functions. Now, the danger to do that is that the ever-changes will say, aha, well, okay, if you don't agree with this popular theory of mind, then you're not going to like ever. But if you do, you seem to stop criticizing us, which we get having other objections. So it all turns on. I don't think that's a good case. I think there are further deep problems that are going to arise even as we take this on board. So I'm going to suggest, as a sort of argumentative strategy, that we sort of accept this. Let me at least flesh out where, as I understand it, everything's going to take this. They're going to say something like this. If we've got orthogonal decomposition of the wave function, it's bad for some reasonable time interval. And if some or all of these individual terms, psi of t's, could individually be interpretable as describing macroscopic creatures whose brains are interacting with a largely classical macroscopic world, then those creatures are real conscious beings having the experiences inspired by the corresponding wave function. In the sort of college, for example, this is a conscious person having seen pointed up, this is a conscious person having seen pointed out, etc. Is this a precise rule? No, it's not. And it's nobody claims it to be. Advocates don't claim it. This splitting is not very precise. Even the number of terminal resources don't be applied. How do you decide whether two worlds that are almost identical and look pretty classical? How do you decide at what point become distinct? There's no fundamental rule there. Isn't that only a problem for this line of thought? Well, maybe you might think it is. You're going to get a pretty robust response from quantum functionists, for instance, from David Wallace and Simon Saunders. They will say, absolutely no, it's not a problem at all. Higher level theories, chemistry, biology, anthropology, sociology, anything to do with theory of mind, it always has been and always will be inherently fuzzily related to fundamental physics. Even in Newtonian mechanics, we never had a precise definition of the human being, we never had a precise definition of the brain, and yet we thought at least we're functionists, we thought we had a sensible theory of mind in that situation. We managed to cope with the fuzziness in classical theories. We can cope equally well with inherent fuzziness in everything. If you want a sort of little slogan about how we deal with fuzziness in the classical world, well, they'll say things like this. It makes no sense. You would be there. It intrinsically makes no sense to say, well, I will date you, even only if there's a crime done. My body isn't the sort of thing that has a precise number of atoms in it. Try again after lunch. All right, so let me make explicit the concession I've already made. You might very reasonably, very well, not be comfortable with functionalism, and you might very well not be comfortable with the strategy of tolerating fuzziness. And I confess, I don't think I am. But I suggest we run with them anyway, for two reasons. Reason one, otherwise we're going to get tangled up in a debate about the mind-body problem, how minds are related to physical world. And the sad fact is that whether or not one has functionalism, there isn't much that's clearly superior out there. Nobody seems to have an uncontroversial superior account of how mind relates to the physical world. And the second reason is, We need to decide whether Everettianism makes perfect sense given this theory of mind, or whether it runs into deep problems even if we allow the Everettians a free pass on this point. So I propose to give them a free pass at least for the next hour or two.
Yeah. If you tolerate fuzziness in this theory, why is it superior to collapse of wave function? In that case, that's also a fuzziness. Why is one fuzziness better than the other?
Again, so channeling as best I can for people who believe in this, they would say, fuzziness is necessarily there already in our theory of mind. It always has been. And so we should only, we have to expect it in an interpretation of quantum theory when we're discussing the relation of mind to ontology. Copenhagen quantum mechanics is introducing something extra. It's introducing a fuzziness into the fundamental ontology. It says predictions do get applied away, which does collapse, but it's not quite sure what. Everettians will claim our ontology is precise. We just have unitary evolving universal wave function. That's great. And now we've got to tackle the theory of mind. Here is the best available theory of mind that we, Everettians, believe is right. Anyway, let's pursue that. We've been as precise as one could possibly go to be, given what we know about the mind body. Again, I'm asking for this kind of channel of perspective. Okay. Let me just for the moment say something that I think is pretty much common ground on all sides of the debate, which is refreshing. The fact is, of course, we don't have a quantum theory of gravity, we don't have a good quantum theory of cosmology, and we really can't until we have a quantum theory of gravity. And we don't have enough power people on which to implement those. But if we did have all those things, pretty much everybody shares the same sort of intuition about the broad structure of how things look at the universal wave function. Here's the universal wave function. You would be able to split it up into an enormous number of different terms, each of which, assuming these theories are right, and given what we know about them, many of which must contain quasi-classical worlds with many different detailed arrangements of quasi-classical matter. So different distributions of galaxies in the different worlds, different distributions of stars in the galaxy, our sun located in slightly different places, the Earth located in slightly different distances from the sun, Waterloo Lake having a slightly different shape. Pretty much any historical event that had some sort of quantum influence could have gone one way or another, and will have gone one way or another in some of these different components. And these components will include some of them, human civilizations on Earth, and those civilizations will have many different histories, evolutionary and sociological. And included amongst those, although generally with much smaller amplitude, are some histories relying on what Copenhagen events would tell us are events that were very, very important. So, you can imagine history, you can imagine evolutionary histories in which some chemical process that relies on a tunneling through a large barrier, a large potential barrier. Although it's supposed to be a problem that wouldn't come in the case, you can imagine a class of life forms that have evolved to rely on the fact that this thing will always work. And there's some non-zero probability that it will always work. And so there's some component in the universe of question which that was a successful evolutionary strategy. And this transition from chemical X to chemical Y always takes place, and it's a crucial part of these creatures' metabolism. And they just go along merrily metabolizing away, converting X into Y as what's in our world seems to be the increasing way. You can imagine little creatures who often are trying to run away from predators. He's a big predator. And their strategy, whenever they're faced with us through a brick wall, is to jump in and hope that they will quantum tunnel through it. And the attitude is pretty damn small, but it's non-zero. And so, this is too extreme an example, in some of these worlds, these creatures that jump the walls and get through the walls and then escape their predators and then Earth is coming to strategy and so by brick wall. And so it goes. And if we take slightly more orthodox things, there are worlds in which human history was the same up to about 1900. And then when we started doing the experiments that laid in our world of quantum theory, we got results that Copenhagen would be statistically anomalous. And so we never succeeded in developing quantum theory, and perhaps we succeeded in developing, perhaps they were consistently anomalous in such a way that we can see succeeded in developing some alternative version of quantum theory. Or perhaps they were so anomalous that we developed something that really didn't look like quantum theory at all. All of that's in there. All of that's possible. Many, many improbable, according to Copenhagen, evolutionary histories. Not realized in their writing. Well, let's see. I think it's fair to say that people on both sides of the debate would accept that state of intuition. And by the way, some of these can be very beneficial in terms of attraction. So in some of these histories, the Earth will have far more human beings than it now does, because we so to speak, cheated in our metabolism. We get more than we could have paid for the things that allows us, and we manage families of escaping predators, or we just live longer because aging processes that normally happen turn out to just not happen.
So is there a history where everything else is kind of the same, except for you just told me exactly the opposite?
Yeah.
And should I know that, and then that's equally acceptable?
I don't think that's a fact, though. I mean, sure, all sorts of things could have happened in this lecture room in different histories, and some you have to decide which one. Which ones are people in the literature, not people in the sense, and which ones are people in the literature in the sense. There's no reason why you should have the same response to different definitions in different histories. Okay, so given that, if I accept that intuition, here's a key question. Everything. If all that is right, what
why is it that, and if universal quantum theory is right, why is it that we find ourselves to be the sort of people who belong to a species that seems to have, as far as we can understand, seems to evolve without relying on anti-deviations, Copenhagen quantum mechanics? Why is it that some people who accumulated experimental data which led us to Copenhagen quantum mechanics rather than something else? Now, in one worldview, a view in which only one branch is realized, whatever other problems that could face, this is sort of question you can't clear answer, the answer as well. Does anyone who have realized, and it wasn't, there aren't any tunneling creatures, there aren't any enormous metabolisms. Isn't true.
So long as they can go away. But when are you going to bring a living one of you?
Is this a good time for it? And it wasn't okay, the answer to my. Why we're the sort of people who see quantum mechanics. So that's all there is. We just realized once, and it is realized quantum. And when we do that, whatever the answer is, it simply can't be that. So clearly everything's going to have to say something at this point. And pretty clearly, it's going to be something that involves observing that the amplitudes for these anomalous worlds are small, and they're going to have to give some story about what size they are. Some account, because even if it can't be a standard account, some account probability or something that takes the data probability that gives some sort of advanced rates. So let's break here and continue with that.
Are we going to the lecture?